Hey there, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If security and the Internet of Things are your thing, I wanted to let you know about a great event Security Ledger is hosting on June 19th in Boston. It's the fifth Security of Things Forum. It's a full day of great content on securing the Internet of Things. If you're interested in learning more and either presenting or just attending the forum, text the word THINGS, that's THINGS, to the number 345-345 on your cell phone. That's THINGS to 345-345. You can also point your web browser to the event website, securityofthings.com, to learn more, to submit an abstract for a talk, or to register. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode, number 89, in the wake of revelations about the doings of billionaire-backed firm Cambridge Analytica, is it time to get off Facebook? We speak with an expert at the Internet Society about why deleting your Facebook account might not solve your online privacy problems. Also, companies are convinced that insecure Internet of Things devices will result in them being hacked, but they're not doing anything to stop it. That's a conclusion of a new Ponemon Institute survey out today. We'll talk to one of the sponsors of that survey to find out what gives. But first, when an autonomous vehicle operated by the ride-sharing firm Uber struck and killed 49-year-old Elaine Hertzberg as she walked across a street in Tempe, Arizona last week, authorities investigating the incident were quick to say that neither Uber's self-driving car nor the human attendant inside it was to blame for the accident. That didn't stop Uber from pulling its autonomous vehicles from the streets of Tempe, as well as Pittsburgh, Toronto, and other cities. But what do we know about the safety of autonomous vehicles that are popping up on U.S. streets? And with more than 30,000 fatalities in the U.S. every year attributed to car accidents, most the result of human error, is there any downside to accelerating the transition to computer-guided cars? In our first segment, we invite Bo Woods of the Atlantic Council back to the Security Ledger studios. Woods says that the answer to the question of how heartily to embrace autonomous vehicles involves more than just statistics.
My name is Bo Woods. I am Cyber Safety Innovation Fellow with the Atlantic Council, and I'm a volunteer with I Am the Cavalry. It's really interesting to watch as these stories develop over the years. The stats that I've heard, I think it was Administrator Rosekind of the Department of Transportation give, were that there's something like 35,000 automotive deaths on the highway, U.S. highways every year. Something like 94% of those are human attributed. In other words, humans caused them. And then the thinking goes, most, if not all of those deaths could be avoided if we have something like autonomous vehicles, right? For some level of autonomy, and they have different levels. So really, if you look at the balance of, you know, what we're trying to optimize for with autonomous vehicles, the trade-offs are, if we can get there and get there quickly, we'll save something like 80 lives a day every single day that we have autonomous vehicles rather than driver-piloted vehicles. So goes the thinking, right? And I think that there's a lot of value, therefore, in, you know, racing towards or speeding towards autonomous vehicles as quickly as we can. On the other hand, if we move too quickly and we move faster than public trust and public confidence will merit, then people will turn away from these autonomous vehicles, and, you know, incidents like hitting a pedestrian, as we recently saw, or incidents like a driver on autopilot in a Tesla having a fatal accident, those things will chill the general population from adopting these technologies. So we've got to balance the actuality of vehicles with the perception of autonomous vehicles if we want to move as fast as possible to save as many lives as we can, as quickly as we can.
Bo, should we be concerned that there haven't been enough controlled experiments and vetting of this technology, that we're turning city streets into kind of live fire ranges for autonomous vehicles, or are those concerns overblown?
Well, the new kind of mantra of software development in the internet connected era is production is your new dev environment, your new test environment. And when you're talking about like a mobile app or a web app, that can be okay, right? The consequences of failure are fairly low if, you know, like Netflix, sometimes somebody logs in and they have to reload the website to come back up and running. So those types of consequences are acceptable.
I mean, isn't that terrible when that happens? Isn't that the worst thing ever when you have to reload and log back into the Netflix app?
Yeah, right. I mean, it's, as the kids would say, literally the worst.
It is literally the worst.
Anyway, but when the consequences rise to a certain level of severity, and I don't think we've mapped that out in the gray space, but I think there's plenty of black and white, then, you know, sometimes when the consequences rise to a certain level, failure is not an acceptable thing because you can't just reload, right? When you have, you know, a fatal error in a programming application causes a fatal error on the highway, that's not okay. You can't reboot life. You can't restart it. So we have to be very thoughtful and intentional about how we go about testing and developing these autonomous vehicle systems. And as to whether or not we're moving too quickly, technically, I don't know the answer to that. You know, I don't know where the state of autonomous driving is in comparison with where it needs to be. There's probably some autonomous vehicle experts who will argue it both ways. But what I will say I've observed is that in the non-technical space, it does seem like we're moving a little bit faster with implementing autonomous vehicles on the road in comparison with what the public is ready and willing to accept eagerly.
You make a good point. It's not really about statistics, whether autonomous vehicles are safer than human-driven vehicles, but it's more about the public perception and the need to manage that.
I generally tend to look at the public trust as a combination of trustworthiness and perception of trustworthiness. Or, in other words, trust is a perception of trustworthiness. So you can either improve the perception, improve the actual trustworthiness, or you can improve both. And ideally, we'll improve both at a rate that's psychologically acceptable for the majority, or even the vast majority of the people who are going to benefit from these technologies.
There seem to be two different issues here. You and the cavalry weigh on the cybersecurity of these systems and whether they're vulnerable to attack or whether they're designed in a secure and resilient fashion. And then there's the issue of the operation of the technology itself and whether it's reliable in a real-world environment. So, Bo, if the goal is to improve both the effectiveness of the software and also the public perception of the effectiveness of the software, how do you do that? I mean, where does the control come in and what form does it take?
So companies like Uber and others want to get autonomous cars on the road, not just for a public safety use, but also for commercial purpose, right? They're trying to save money on the cost of their fleets, trying to get more cars on the road, which can increase their top line revenue. So they're trying to move forward as quickly as possible. I think the public safety angle is one that traditionally is looked after by Department of Transportation, in other words, by the government, right, of whatever country you're in, because left to its own devices, a purely profit-driven company is going to look out for its own shareholders. In fact, it must look out for its own shareholders rather than a public safety mechanism and a feeling of public safety. Usually those two are in line, but in some circumstances, they can be in conflict. And so that's the role, traditionally, that's been the role of a regulator like the Department of Transportation, like the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, to look after and kind of act as a governor on the top speed of adoption of some of these technologies or trying new experimental things before they're well-tested and vetted. On the cybersecurity side, I heard a great description. Somebody posted a great description on Twitter of what a cybersecurity incident is and what a cybersecurity researcher does or a malicious hacker. And essentially, what they said is something like hackers are experts at taking very, very rare cases and making them reliable and repeatable. In other words, these things where we see accidents or incidents that people say, oh, well, that's a once in a million or once in a billion chance. What hackers and what security researchers are able to do is to increase the odds of that one in a billion chance to one in 10 chance, maybe. And that, I think, is one of the things that most people in traditional manufacturing don't really factor for when they're designing these systems. In other words, they design for the intended use of the system, not the unintended use or abuse cases of the system.
One thing that has surprised me a lot is this Wild West environment that's evolved, where you can have a company like Tesla push an update to vehicles on the road that basically adds a feature where you can take your hands off the steering wheel. And the U.S. government, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or the Department of Transportation are totally out of the loop on that. So they're not in a position to choose to vet that feature before it's pushed out to beta. And, you know, basically you've got Tesla doing beta tests on highways with vehicles that are going 70, mm-hmm. 80, 90 miles an hour. It just seems kind of crazy to me, especially when you consider how high the bar is for other safety features in vehicles.
I'm really, really conflicted about this. I don't know where the right line is to draw between, you know, we need to get autonomous vehicles out as quickly as possible, and we need to preserve public trust in these systems, and we need to ensure that, you know, dangerous things are kept off the road. That's such a tough choice. I'm glad I'm not in the hot seat of having to figure out where those lines are. And so I'm not, I personally wouldn't feel comfortable analyzing or second guessing any of those decisions. I know you're not asking me to, but look, we're going to have to be making those types of decisions more and more every single day. I think one way to look at it is magnitude of potential harm versus magnitude of potential benefit, right? What's the total maximum harm that can come from something like an autonomous vehicle crash? You know, the total maximum harm, if there's 100 vehicles on the road, and I don't know what the total number, you know, 100, let's just say 100 autonomous vehicles in the road. If all of them, for some reason, you know, to be determined later, cause a 2 or 3 car crash, some number of people will die from that, but it will be, I don't know, maybe less than a couple of hundred. That's a fairly low number in the grand scheme of things, right? That's double the normal daily rate of attrition, you know, deaths on our roads. And once that happens, autonomous vehicle makers will probably be banned from the roads until an investigation occurs and we can find out what goes on. The public will lose a lot of confidence. And I'm just kind of thinking through this out loud, so there's not any forethought that's gone into this. Public will lose confidence. It'll set us back a ways, no matter who the car company is that does this, whether it's Tesla, whether it's Uber, whether it's somebody else, no matter who the company is, it will taint the whole autonomous vehicle market. So you might potentially delay for a decade, let's say, rollout of an autonomous fleet, which would be highly problematic. On the other hand, that's a potential maybe risk that can also potentially maybe be backstopped in other ways after it happens, whereas the certain risk of avoiding autonomous vehicles altogether is tens of thousands of lives per year. So that's the hard math to do, and it's something that we'll have to repeat in hospitals and medical devices, which are very near and dear to my heart, in airplanes, in you know, building automation systems, and in other places where, you know, in a lot of those, the consequences of failure are just as high, if not higher, than autonomous vehicles because of the widespread distribution, the direct impact on human life, and other things. So, look, we better get good at making these decisions, because if we don't, the future looks awfully bleak.
It seems in some other ways that the regulations and regulators that we have are not well suited to this environment where technology is moving so quickly. On the other hand, I can see that there might be dangers to just taking all the stops off and letting the industry throw itself headlong into this world without any oversight.
Yeah, I think that's that trust and trustworthiness is going to be the thing that has the most profound impact on adoption of technology and of saving lives over the long term. So I'm generally a big fan of transparency and transparency mechanisms. I think it has a tendency to make information available by which we can make better decisions and more trustworthy, trusted decisions. On the other hand, if there's not a good story to tell with that transparency, then it leaves the interpretation up to the reader, right? And really up to the storyteller. So if it's just raw data, anyone can tell whatever story they want to, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics. So I tend to feel like, yes, greater transparency can bolster public confidence. On the other hand, I also want to, especially in light of, you know, the current trend towards non-fact-based news, I think we have to be careful with what preconditions we sow in a field of uncertain incentives.
If we get a reaction from this, so if all of a sudden state or federal lawmakers say, hold on, you know, we need to take a new look at this. We've got a person who's dead in Tempe. We need to swoop in and have hearings and pass laws. Is that not the right way to go? I mean, it's understandable. It's an understandable response, but is it not the right response?
Yeah, it's a great question. The way I would like to see these things go is, instead of swooping in to take action, let's swoop in to have a public dialogue about what we want to see technology do, not just what can we see technology do. In other words, we reach the point where we no longer have to ask, can a technology do something? The answer is almost always yes. But we haven't yet started asking seriously, what should our technology do for us? And I think that in a more general sense is the kind of thing that we need to see broadly across many of these different areas, from autonomous vehicles to healthcare, to industrial control systems, to Internet of Things in our homes. So I would like to see many more of those types of conversations happen in a crucial public dialogue with folks from across a spectrum of societal perspectives.
Bo Woods of the Atlantic Council, thanks so much for coming in to speak with the Security Ledger podcast.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
Up next, the dastardly business dealings between Facebook and the billionaire-backed firm Cambridge Analytica have been making headlines since the New York Times revealed that Cambridge Analytica mined data on some 50 million Facebook users in order to manipulate their feelings and thoughts and maybe tip the electoral scales in favor of the candidacy of Donald Trump. That has prompted mea culpas from Facebook executives, including CEO Mark Zuckerberg, as well as calls for Mr. Zuckerberg to testify before Congress. But what will it take to really plug the gaping privacy hole at Facebook and other social media firms? Our next guest, Konstantinos Komaitis of the Internet Society, said that a good first step would be for social media companies to start showing more care in how they collect and handle user data. In this next segment, we talk with him about that group's new list of recommendations to address lax privacy practices online and about how the pending EU's General Data Protection Regulation might bring some relief.
My name is Konstantinos Komaitis, and I am the Director for Policy Development at the Internet Society. The Internet Society is a global not-for-profit organization that was established in 1992 by the people who actually created the Internet. The idea was to create a body that would, first of all, provide the organizational home to the Internet Engineering Task Force. This is a community of engineers that gathers in order to create the standards for the Internet. And secondly, to create a society, that's the name, that would be able to expand the use and the importance of the Internet throughout the world. First of all, we do realize and appreciate that this is not just limited to Facebook, right? These are all platforms that one way or the other interact with users and collect their data. At a higher level, the Internet Society, we believe that we need higher and stricter standards for transparency and ethics when it comes to the handling of our information.
So much of what we've learned about Cambridge Analytica and their use of Facebook data, in some ways, it wasn't really news. I mean, we kind of knew that big firms like Facebook and Google were both collecting and selling data on their users. It's more or less their business model. Why do you think this particular instance or this particular story has really struck a nerve and really prompted this huge backlash, I guess, or, you know, reaction?
I will challenge you a little bit. I wouldn't necessarily use the word we knew. We certainly suspected it. We certainly suspected that knowing Facebook and Google and knowing that their business model is based actually on data collection in order to be selling it to advertisers, we knew that our data was being used in certain ways. It was used for targeted advertising, but I don't think we ever fathomed A, the magnitude, and B, and more importantly, the fact that our data is not just being sold now, it's being sold and resold to third parties with the ultimate goal that have specific goals and specific outcomes. And in the case of Cambridge Analytica, it was actually to manipulate elections, which none of the users of Facebook or of any other platform for that matter had signed up for that. So to an extent, if you want, suspecting that, yes, I will log on to Facebook and because I happen to check a website, let's say, on gyms, I will get a targeted advertising on that. And I sort of sign up to that, because it doesn't really bother me and it makes my life a little bit easier and more efficient. But knowing that, and also I am part of a much bigger pool, I am not identified individually. Right now what has happened is that individuals were profiled according to their preferences and according to their likes in order then to be manipulated in order to vote one way or the other in given elections.
Right, right. So you guys say that, one of your big recommendations, and you've come out with a number, I think 6 recommendations for improvements as a result of, you know, what we've learned, is that, big firms like Facebook should make policies about data handling that reflect the interests of users first. So kind of walk me through that. What would that mean in terms of changes to the way Facebook now handles data or the way that they historically have handled user data?
So, Paul, if I may, I think this is the million-dollar question, right? For a long, long time, as we've discussed, we know that data is very, very important for some business models operating at the layer of the web. So there are different ways of, and there's a lot of thinking as to how we go about making sure that our data is handled according to our interests. There is not going to be a perfect model, and definitely the Internet Society does not have the perfect answer. But what we know and what the recent events have demonstrated clearly is that there needs to be a much better communication between platforms and users as to how the data is used. And more importantly, platforms need to understand much better the interests of users when they use their data. You can do it through different ways, I guess. For example, as you may know, recently, in a couple of months, a huge European regulation called the GDPR is going to come into force. And part of what they're trying to do, what this regulation is trying to do, is actually give more power to the users when it comes to their data. Now, we don't necessarily have to go down to the path of regulation in order to achieve that. There are other tools, there can be tools within the platforms themselves that would allow users and the platforms to communicate and demonstrate clear consent rules, for example, opt-ins and opt-outs. You know, the default in most of the cases is opt-in. It should really be opt-out. Transparency as to how my data is used and whether, you know, I am consenting or not consenting for my data to be used in the way that it does. Even in the beginning, clearly, understanding what I'm signing up for and upfront. And I'm not talking here about terms of references, because terms of references are very complex, legal, and I will say even tedious documents that users do not necessarily spend time reading. Mm-hmm. So we need to reverse the conversation. There is a certain degree of responsibility by these platforms when they're using the data to be very clear and transparent as to how this data is used.
You anticipated my next question, which was about GDPR. Will GDPR, which again is really an EU regulation, but it impacts any company that handles data on behalf of EU residents. Will GDPR basically do most of this work or make most of these changes for us, regardless of what Facebook or Google might want to do, or not? Under GDPR, would it still be possible for Facebook or Google to act in the way that they've acted in recent years, and for a company like Cambridge Analytica to come along and really exploit access to their data?
So I think it's a little bit premature to say yes or no to your questions. However, what I think we can safely argue is that the GDPR would certainly provide a nudge towards that direction. This is a legislation coming out from a very, very key actor in the in the world, the European Union. And as you said, it seeks to deal with personal data of any European citizen that is held by any company around the world. So for me, and the way we see this actually working, non-compliance is not really an option. Whether it will work as legislation or not, I think it's very early to tell, but the first indications coming out and the reactions as to how platforms are responding to this regulation is that they are very much appreciating that this is happening, and they are deploying tools, resources in order to be able and deal with and comply with the requirements of the GDPR. So certainly to the extent that the GDPR seeks to A, give users more power over how their data is handled, and B, ensure that they feel comfortable about how their data is circulates around the internet, I think it could provide a very interesting case study for industry, for example, to follow, even in the context of self-regulation. Take parts of it and apply it. This is what is going to be very interesting now, to see all these models that will be emerging as part, as a response to what has happened. And we need to be smart enough, and we need to be quick enough to take those tools that we know that work and just put them all together and make sure that they are provided to users when it comes to protecting their data.
Many Facebook users have responded by deleting their accounts, or at least saying that they're going to, sever ties with Facebook, stop using it. Is that the right response to this, or to kind of cut ties with the network, or not?
I really like this question, and I have been spending quite some time thinking about it. There are a lot of opinions out there. I personally, and this is my own personal view, I am really in the camp of people that do not believe deleting Facebook is going to fix the problem. And the reason for that is because exit is much easier in theory than in practice. we need to bear in mind that currently Facebook has created this space where people communicate with family and friends. They do business. There are a lot of businesses that are actually, you know, operating through Facebook. They're receiving their news, whether it's real or fake, that is a completely different conversation, but it is a source of receiving the news. And also, in some parts of the world, let's not forget that for some people in some parts of the world, Facebook, mistakenly so, is the only access to the internet. That's what they consider internet. So leaving Facebook or exiting Facebook sounds like a very noble and lovely idea, but in practice, it is much, much harder than we think and we appreciate.
The internet society, you're kind of the, in some ways, the keepers of the flame for the internet and what the internet started out as, which was very utopian in its vision of, you know, what this global network would realize. These types of incidents have really revealed kind of another side of the internet that's a little bit more dystopian, I think, than utopian. What is it going to take to kind of learn the lessons of the last couple years and get the internet more aligned with its, idealistic and utopian origins?
So thank you very much for this question. And the reason that I say thank you is because there is, ever since, actually, it has been going on for quite some time, there is more and more anger and more frustration and more blaming on the internet itself. In this specific issue, we need to separate the internet and many others, but in this specific one, we need to separate the internet from the web, right? The things that currently are happening at a layer of the internet, which is the web, which is a reflection of the internet in many ways, but it is not the internet itself. And interestingly, which I find the whole irony behind what is happening, the internet was created originally to be agnostic. It doesn't care what sort of data it carries. It doesn't care whether you are male or female, sending video or audio or doing whatever. Strangely enough, we are in a place currently where it's all about data. And actually, not only do we care about the data, but we also identify you. So that's the first point. But you are very true in identifying that over the course of actually, it's been years now, right? There is a trust issue that is happening in the internet. And we have seen and we have noticed the levels of trust declining ever since Snowden. And currently, unfortunately, you know, this continues with the latest turn of events. What can we do to go back? We need to go back to a place of trust. And this is very abstract, and I do very much get it, that, you know, there is nothing specific. But incidents like that help us understand what we mean by going back to that trust and how transparency and accountability become key elements in moving forward. If we really want to get past this and learn from what has happened, transparency and accountability are key and they are non-negotiable. The responsibility of anybody who operates on the internet, whether we as users, we need to be responsible in finding out and demanding more information about where our data is used, how it's being handled, whether, you know, there are things that are happening that we do not know, but at the same time, companies need to be responsible, to be transparent, and to be accountable, especially with regards to how they use our data and telling us that, you know, in this case, it was mishandled. Your data was mishandled. And these are the steps that we are taking. Instead of waiting for news to come out that suddenly, where we suddenly realize that our data has been misused and in ways that are quite dangerous.
Konstantinos, is there anything more that I should have asked you that I didn't?
No, I think that, the only thing that I would say is that if we are to continue to benefit from the value of the internet, and I sit in a place where I really truly believe that the internet can bring huge value to people, and we should not forget the value that it can bring, we need to go to a place where the relationship between the platforms, the services that we are provided, changes significantly, and we are entering, you know, a relationship of peers where we are where the user is at the center.
Konstantinos Komaitis of the Internet Society, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us on the Security Ledger.
Thank you so very much for having me.
And finally, a new survey from the Ponemon Institute and the Santa Fe Group's Shared Assessments Program has some worrying data on risk and the Internet of Things. There's a near universal concern among enterprises that they're going to suffer an IoT-linked security event within the next couple of years. What's surprising, though, is that few of the surveyed firms has any notion of how to prevent such an incident from occurring. Charles Miller, a senior vice president at the Santa Fe Group, joined us in the Security Ledger Studios to talk about the implications of the Ponemon survey and about one of the major conclusions of the survey, namely that risk management practices at organizations are not keeping up with the pace of technology adoption.
This is Charles Miller. I'm a senior vice president with the Santa Fe Group Shared Assessments Program. So this is the third study with regard to third-party risk, and this is the second year that we've done the one specifically related to the Internet of Things. We interviewed about 605 individuals who are well-versed in risk management techniques within their own organizations and also have a good understanding of what their third-party risk management techniques and posture is across the organizations. So there was a couple of pieces of good news. One was that there is a better understanding of the risks associated with the Internet of Things and what that poses to corporations and organizations. But it seems as if the ability to manage or mitigate that risk is not progressing as fast as the threat potential is. So that was one of the big concerns that we had. There was a overwhelming concern that an IoT-caused security event or incident would occur within the next 2 years. I think it was 97%, almost universal, that would happen. So that, you know, that says that they're aware that this risk exists, but they're not probably stepping up as fast as they need to. And then the other piece is that it was surprising that we found that the reliance for mitigating that third-party risk is housed in contractual clauses with the third party and or policies and procedures. So you know, so if you're relying on that type of technique in terms of policies and procedures or contractual clauses, the ability to monitor those contract clauses and that those policies needs to be in sync with that so that you can actually ensure that you're complying with those clauses. So we don't see that as the follow-on yet. I think that's a lot of work that has to be done to ensure that we do have those monitoring techniques in place to do that. You know, the other piece was there's not a lot of folks who are keeping an inventory of these devices. So we've historically seen, even with third parties that are supporting organizations, a very difficult time understanding all of the relationships that exist. And this introduction of the IoT things really complicates this much more because you have internal devices that are used to support your own corporation as well as those that may be used to support service providers that are supporting the services that you're offering to your clients. So I think that complication in the landscape is really making this a much more difficult task than perhaps people are thinking it's going to be.
You guys found, I think you said 97% of the people who responded, the 600 or so people who did this survey,
right,
said that unsecured Internet of Things devices could be, I think you guys said, a catastrophic risk for the organization, but
right,
almost half of them didn't even really have an inventory of those devices. Where's the disjunction happening there? If there is such concern about managing security risks with Internet of Things devices. How come that hasn't translated into kind of practical steps to do that?
Good question. I think that's a great question. I'm not sure if I have an exact answer for that, but I'll give it a shot. I think the area that is of concern is that no single, that we saw in this study, was that no single part of the organization was given accountability to make sure that this kind of kept current, that there's an inventory, right, that there is an approval process for bringing on devices that are going to support the business units. It's kind of a little bit all over the map. So I think that clear accountability and maybe some centralization, or at least knowing and communicating and knowing within your organization who is accountable for this stuff, is really important. We think that there's still this open kind of accountability issue, Paul, that, you know, people are still not stepping up.
I mean, we're used to thinking about IoT risk, like with the Mirai botnet, you know, huge denial of service attack from, you know, compromised Internet of Things devices. What are the risks for organizations that IoT, that insecure or improperly configured IoT devices pose?
Yeah, so I think the distributed denial of service is one of those risks, quite clearly, you know, just given the move to the cloud, that there's a lot of concentration of a lot of different services in certain providers. So that concentration risk, if there is a distributed denial of service, that could, you know, impact a large number of corporations. That's one area. I think you know, Larry spends a lot of time with data breach, and, you know, given some of the things that are data breaches and the reporting of data breaches and incident response. So I think that's another area that, you know, given some of the things that are happening in Europe this year with GDPR, mm-hmm, and the need for all of the notifications that have to go to individuals as well as to the regulators if there is a breach, that's another area. So that data exfiltration is something that, you know, everybody's kind of concerned about in terms of, you know, how those data breaches are being reported and acted and corrected as they happen. Yeah, so I think those two are big areas from a security incident perspective that need to be addressed. And then I think the other piece is incident response plans really probably include what you need to do with regard to IoT devices if they're involved in the incident. You know, how do you ensure that is taken offline? How do you ensure that risk is identified, isolated, kind of mitigated and corrected kind of going forward? So I think that's another area that has to be addressed as well.
And obviously, I mean, companies have invested, you know, a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars in IT security products and monitoring tools in the last 20 years. So I guess the question is, do they need to now go out and find and purchase different gear? And so is this a wholly different problem, or merely just a little bit of a coverage gap that needs to be addressed?
I think it's more of a coverage gap, because we do have a number of solutions that are looking at, you know, risks from a continuous monitoring perspective. And I think that's an area that, you know, is showing a lot of promise. It's not just to assess once and kind of go in and make sure that it's fixed. But this is to continually monitor in near real time, you know, events that happen, and then take corrective action as quickly as you can. So we think it's an extension, because it's very security related. It has the same type of features or similar types of features to what devices and, like, bring your own device and, you know, mobile devices and things like that are out there already. So it's probably an extension to some of the solutions that are in place. But I don't think people have really kind of turned that corner yet and kind of really given it a hard look as to what the risks are and then what are some of the solutions that need to be integrated into those solutions that they're providing for other types of risks that they may be monitoring for. So we get some work to do there.
Yeah. So to that point, you know, if you're listening to this, what are your recommendations? Where do you start with addressing this IoT risk problem within your organization?
There were five recommendations that we came up with, Larry and his team and our team. One is, obviously, need to get a better handle on inventory. So update your asset management solutions to include these types of devices. Second, as I mentioned, accountability. So make sure that you have and communicate who is accountable within your organization for dealing and handling Internet of Things activities, all right, and devices and applications. And the other piece is, you know, that when you're doing management reporting to your boards or to your governance structures, make sure that you begin to include IoT devices and IoT risks included in that package of reporting. So I think that's really to get the message up to the top, because there still is this disconnect between the tone at the top and the risk professionals that are experiencing all of these things down in the trenches, so to speak. And then I think the other piece is, you know, we mentioned the use of contracts and policies and procedures, but if you do, and that's great, I mean, there's a really important piece to have, but if you include those and leverage those, make sure you have some type of monitoring in place to ensure that those contract clauses and policies are being adhered to. That's the key thing. And I think that's a really important thing. And then, as we've talked about, is that this is we're seeing a lot of creative solutions being put forth, but as those solutions go forward from a technology perspective and from a industry and from a even from a regulatory perspective, work with your peers to identify those solutions that will address some of the risks that we're seeing with regard to the Internet of Things. I think that's for both devices and applications. I think that's an important part to collaborate.
Charlie Miller of Shared Assessments, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much.